Hey everyone, welcome to our deep dive into the history of interpretation. You know, it's funny, we've got this really interesting collection of material for today.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just about, trying to figure out like what the Bible means, for instance,
Right.
but we're going way beyond that. We're going to be looking at how these really big ideas about meaning and understanding, like how they've influenced how we think about anything, pretty much any field you can think of.
It's true. I mean, so many of the ways that we think today, you can trace them all the way back to some of these historical debates about interpretation. We're going to be kind of time traveling today through different eras and seeing how those shifts impact how we interpret everything, even something as simple as like a text message, you know?
And we've got some heavy hitters on our list today. We're talking Francis Bacon, René Descartes, John Locke, Immanuel Kant, and Friedrich Schleiermacher.
Okay, good group.
Don't worry, we'll make sure this is a fun, not stuffy trip through history.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things that's really cool about this topic is we're going to be tackling some questions that are, I mean, they're seriously thought-provoking questions. And people are still debating these questions today. Like, can you ever really be objective when you're reading something? Or does the meaning, does it live in the thing itself? Or is it something that the reader kind of creates?
Yeah, that's a great question.
These are big questions.
It's huge. And to kind of kick things off, we're going to be heading straight into the Enlightenment. And you've got some really interesting sources in your stack from that period. And as you know, this was a time when people were really excited about the power of reason and logic. It was almost kind of like this feeling of let's ditch all the old ways of thinking and let's just figure things out for ourselves,
You know, it's funny you say that because even today we still talk about, you know, seeing the light when we understand something. And that's totally a legacy of the Enlightenment. This idea that reason can kind of illuminate the truth is super powerful.
Absolutely. And one of the big names from that era that we'll be talking about today is Francis Bacon, right? And he's often seen as one of the kind of a pioneer of the scientific method. He was all about like observation, careful observation, and then using, data to sort of figure out the laws of nature.
It was all about evidence for him. He was basically saying, don't just rely on what people have always believed. Like, go out there, look at the evidence, do experiments, and see what you discover. And that was pretty radical at the time.
It really was. It was like, let's be detectives of the natural world.
That's a great way to put it.
And I can just imagine how exciting that must have been for people, but also maybe a little bit scary,
I
right?
feel
Like
absolutely.
challenging the old assumptions.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so he emphasized this inductive method, right? Where
Yeah.
you start with your observations and then you kind of draw conclusions from there. And we still see this today. I mean, this is still a big deal, especially in some approaches to biblical studies. You'll see scholars arguing that we can kind of get to the true meaning of a text by looking at it really, really carefully. Almost like, Bacon was dissecting nature.
That's a great way to think about
It
it.
makes sense. But, it also makes me wonder, like, can we really ever be totally objective like that? I mean, don't we all kind of have our own experiences and our own biases that come into play when we're reading something?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? And that's kind of where our next thinker, René Descartes, comes in. He's the guy who famously said, I think, therefore I am. But he was also, you know, really super into the power of reason, believed that we could understand the world logically.
So both Bacon and Descartes, they were both really all about using logic and observation to kind of get to the bottom of
That's
this.
right.
But I guess that raises kind of an interesting question. If we're all thinking beings, doesn't that mean that our minds are always going to be sort of playing a role in how we understand the world?
Exactly. And that's where John Locke, another one of our philosophical giants, comes in. He's the one who gives us this idea, this really, really influential idea of the mind as a tabula rasa, which is Latin for basically a blank slate. So it's like imagining your mind as a fresh whiteboard, just waiting for experience to write on it.
That's such a cool image. It's very appealing, right? Like you're starting with this completely clean slate, no preconceived notions, just totally open to new ideas. It's a nice idea.
Right. But here's the thing. It's a really appealing idea, but it also brings up some tough questions. Like, if we really are blank slates, how do we actually make sense of anything? I mean, think about the sources you sent us for this deep dive. I mean, you already knew something about these ideas before you even started reading, right?
Wait, a blank slate. That's true. I guess, I did bring my own curiosity about history and philosophy and all this stuff. So how can we understand anything at all if we don't already have like some kind of framework or categories for organizing all this new information?
Yeah. It's like trying to do a jigsaw puzzle, but you have no idea what the picture is supposed to look like.
Right.
You need some existing knowledge.
Right.
You need some way to connect the pieces, you know. And this is where things get really, really interesting.
Okay.
Because our next thinker, Immanuel Kant, basically flips this whole idea on its head.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about this. Yeah, from the readings, I'm getting the sense that Kant was kind of a revolutionary thinker.
He was a total game changer.
Yeah.
Kant comes along and says, hey, hold on a second. You're not just passively, you know, absorbing information.
Okay.
Your mind is actually shaping, it's actively shaping how you see the world.
Whoa. Mind blown. So it's not just like the world is objectively out there and we just see it. We're actually experiencing it through the filter of our own minds.
That's right.
That's kind of scary, but exciting at the same time.
It really is.
Okay.
Yeah, Kant's basically saying it's like we're all wearing these special glasses. And those glasses, those are the structures and categories of our minds. And they determine how we see and understand everything.
So two people can look at the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But because they're wearing different glasses, so to speak,
yeah,
their minds are going to interpret it in totally different ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which then raises this huge question. If our minds are always shaping how we understand the world, can we ever be truly objective? I mean, is there even such a thing as seeing things as they really are?
That's a good question. I mean, does that mean that everyone's interpretation is just as valid as anyone else's?
Yeah. And it's a debate that's still going on today.
Wow.
And you can see Kant's legacy all over this.
Right.
One of the big things he did was he kind of made this distinction between what he called the realm of freedom, which included things like faith and religion, and then the realm of causality, which was like the scientific world of facts and history.
Right.
And he said that those two realms are totally separate and they can't really influence each other.
So it's like he built this wall between faith and facts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can definitely see how that idea is still with us today, right? You see people making this sharp division between their own personal beliefs and then what they consider to be objective, you know, historical evidence.
All the time. And this also had a big impact on biblical studies, too.
Oh, interesting.
Because you have scholars who, following Kant's thinking, they argue that when biblical authors are talking about, you know, theology or faith, they're not really concerned with historical accuracy.
Right.
They're operating in these two totally different worlds.
It's like it's almost like what we're talking about with those two different realms, right?
Yeah.
The realm of faith and the realm of facts. So Kant, on the one hand, he emphasized how much our minds shape everything we understand. But then on the other hand, he creates the separation between, you know, faith and these historical facts.
Yeah.
And that seems like that's going to set up a really interesting tension for our next thinker.
Oh, totally.
Friedrich Schleiermacher.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he comes along and kind of says, hey, hold on a second. There's more to understanding than just, you know, cold, hard reason.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to bring back these ideas of like experience and creativity.
Yeah.
And the importance of understanding the author's perspective.
It sounds like he wasn't trying to throw out reason entirely. But
no.
Yeah.
Not at all. But he just wanted to acknowledge that there's this like human element to it.
For sure.
Especially when we're talking about interpreting texts, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And here's where Schleiermacher really made his mark. He basically shifted the focus of interpretation
away from the text itself and onto the author of the text.
Interesting.
He believed that the ultimate goal of interpretation was to understand the author's intent.
Mm.
Like to basically get inside their head and see the world through their eyes.
So it's not just about analyzing the words on the page.
Right.
It's about understanding the person who actually wrote those words.
That's right.
And that's such a different approach from, you know, the pure objectivity that Bacon and Descartes were all about.
Totally. Yeah. He's like, hey, there's a real human being behind this text.
Right.
And their thoughts and experiences matter.
And to do that, he developed this idea of the hermeneutical circle. And tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but basically it's this back and forth movement between understanding, you know, the whole text.
Get the picture.
The big picture, yeah. And then understanding its individual parts.
The parts, yeah.
And it's like a constant, I don't know, like a dance or something between those two.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to help us get a deeper understanding of the author's intent, right?
Exactly. It's like this constant dance.
Right.
Between the big picture and the little details. And it helps you really get at what the author was trying to say.
It seems like he's saying that understanding is a process.
It is. Yeah. It's not just like an aha moment.
Right. You don't just get it instantly.
Right. Right.
It's something that you have to kind of, you know, work through.
Absolutely.
And I bet that idea of the hermeneutical circle would even apply to like understanding a text message.
Oh, absolutely. Think about a time when you got a text from somebody and it was really short, or maybe it sounded kind of passive aggressive.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, what do they really mean?
Right.
That's the hermeneutical circle in action.
You're right. It's like when my friend texts back, okay, after I ask if they want to hang out,
uh-huh.
my mind just starts going into overdrive trying to like decode that message.
Yeah.
It's like, are they mad at me? Are they just busy? What's the real message here?
Exactly. You're instinctively trying to understand the author, which is your friend in that case.
Yeah.
And their intent. And you're drawing on all these things, like your past experiences with them and your knowledge of their personality and even your own emotional state at that moment.
It's like I'm using all these clues to kind of fill in the gaps and try to figure out what they're really trying to communicate.
And that process, believe it or not, has roots in these ideas that we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
going all the way back to the Enlightenment and beyond. You're using both reason, right? You're analyzing the words themselves. And then you're also trying to have this deeper understanding of the author. You're trying to put those two things together to figure out what's going on.
So even something as everyday as like trying to understand a text message, it's connected to these big philosophical ideas about interpretation.
It is. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it really makes you realize that being a good interpreter, it's not just some, you know, academic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It's a skill that's relevant to pretty much every aspect of our lives.
Yeah. That's such a good point. So we've gone from Bacon's focus on inductive reasoning to Schleiermacher's emphasis on authorial intent.
It's been a wild ride.
It has been a wild ride. We've covered a lot of ground already, but I feel like we've just scratched the surface.
We've just gotten started.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in part two, we're going to take everything we've learned so far and see how these ideas play out in even more everyday situations.
Okay. I'm excited. Can't wait.
See you then.
See you then. Welcome back to our deep dive into the history of interpretation. I feel like we've already learned so much about how these ideas about meaning and understanding have evolved over time.
We have. I mean, we went all the way from the Enlightenment, remember?
Yeah.
That focus on reason and observation with Bacon and Descartes.
Right.
To Locke's idea of the blank slate.
Yeah.
And then Kant. Oh, man. Kant was a game changer.
He really was.
This whole idea that our minds are actually shaping how we understand the world.
Yeah, pretty radical stuff.
And of course, we can't forget Schleiermacher, bringing in the author's perspective and that idea of the hermeneutical circle.
So much good stuff. But now I'm really curious to see how all of these like historical ideas about interpretation actually play out in our like everyday lives.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not walking around thinking about Kant or Schleiermacher.
Right.
When I'm reading like a news article or trying to figure out what my friend meant in a text message, you know?
Right. But their ideas are kind of there in the background, whether we realize it or not.
Okay.
So let's start with something I think a lot of us do every day, which is, you know, reading the news.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that article you sent me about the new economic policy?
Yeah.
That's a perfect example of what Kant was talking about, you know?
Yeah.
With our minds shaping how we understand the world.
Oh, yeah. The one where, like, the author was super optimistic about the policy's potential impact. But then, like, all the comments, you know?
Right.
People were really debating the data and highlighting potential downsides. And
it was like people were reading the same article, but seeing it through completely different lenses, you know?
Yeah.
Based on their own political leanings or their economic background or even just their general outlook on life.
It's like that saying, one person's trash is another person's treasure, but applied to like interpreting information.
Exactly.
It's kind of unsettling, isn't it? It's like, how do we even know what to believe when it seems like everyone has their own interpretation of the facts?
It is unsettling, yeah. But it's also, I think, a chance for us to really put on our interpreter hats.
Okay.
And think critically about what we're reading. Remember what we learned from Kant. None of us are truly objective, right?
Right.
We all have our own biases and preconceived notions that are kind of influencing how we see the world.
Okay. So it's like those two opposing groups of commenters.
Hmm.
They're kind of wearing those different glasses, as Kant put it.
Yeah.
And that's determining how they're interpreting the same data.
That's right.
Okay. I get that. But what about when we're reading something that seems more like objectively true, like a scientific research article, for instance? Surely our biases don't come into play as much then, right?
Well, I don't know about that.
Okay.
Even when we're dealing with scientific data, which, you know, supposed to be objective.
Right.
Our own beliefs and experiences, they can still influence how we interpret that data. Think about climate change research, for instance. You mentioned you'd been reading about that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And there's so much research out there. It's kind of overwhelming to even know where to start sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. And even if the data itself is presented objectively in, you know, a research article, our interpretation of that data is probably going to be colored by what we already believe about climate change.
So you mean like if someone already believes that climate change is like a serious threat, then they might kind of focus more on the findings that support that view. And then someone who's more skeptical of climate change, they might, you know, kind of zoom in on data points that kind of confirm their skepticism.
Right. Or they might even question like the methodology of the study or the researcher's potential biases.
It's like our brains are wired to just look for information that confirms what we already believe.
You got it. That's confirmation bias. And it's a powerful force. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to just to be aware of our own biases, right?
Right.
When we're interpreting any kind of information, whether it's a news article or a scientific study or even like a social media post.
So we're not just blank slates.
No.
Passively absorbing information like Locke suggested.
Not at all. We're active participants in this process of creating meaning, right?
Yeah.
We're bringing our whole selves to the table, our experiences, our beliefs, our values when we interpret something.
Okay. So that's where Schleiermacher's ideas about authorial intent come into play.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because think about it. Whether you're reading, you know, a news article or a scientific study or a blog post, you're engaging with another person's attempt to communicate something.
Right.
They've chosen specific words. They've framed the information in a particular way. And they have a purpose for writing what they wrote.
So to really understand what they're saying, I need to try to understand their perspective, their intent.
Yes.
It's not just about the words on the page.
Not enough. Yeah.
It's about like who wrote those words and why.
You got it.
I love that. It's almost like being a detective, right?
It is. Yeah. You're trying to uncover like the author's motives, their message.
I love that analogy. It makes it so much more active and engaging.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And this applies to even something as simple as, you know, like trying to figure out a text message from a friend.
Oh, this is a good one. I think we've all been there.
Oh, yeah.
Staring at a message, trying to, like, decipher its true meaning.
Yeah.
Like, when you ask someone how they're doing and they just reply with, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, are they really fine? Or is there something more going on beneath the surface?
You're instantly trying to understand the author, which is your friend in that case.
Right.
And their intent. And you're drawing on all these things, like your past experiences with them, your knowledge of their personality, even your own emotional state to, like, read between the lines.
It's like you're using all these clues to, like, crack the code of their message.
And that, believe it or not, that's rooted in the ideas we've been talking about.
Yeah.
You're engaging in this form of interpretation that involves both reason, right, analyze the words, but also this deeper understanding of the author.
So even when we think we're just casually texting, we're actually like tapping into these deeper philosophical ideas about interpretation.
It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, it is. And it really highlights the fact that, you know, being a good interpreter, it's a valuable skill no matter what you're reading or who you're communicating with.
That's a great point. Okay, so we've established we're not blank slates. We're all biased in some way.
Right.
And authorial intent really matters.
Mm.
But how do we actually become better interpreters? Like, do you have any tips or tricks?
Well, I think, you know, the first step is just awareness, right?
Okay.
Recognize that you're not a blank slate. I mean, as tempting as that idea might be, you're bringing your own unique set of experiences and beliefs and values to everything you read and hear.
So I need to be honest with myself about my own biases and how they might be shaping my interpretation.
Yeah, that's huge.
Okay, what else?
I think another key tip is to be charitable.
Okay.
When you're interpreting someone's words, especially in writing, give them the benefit of the doubt whenever possible.
That makes sense. Don't just like assume the worst or jump to conclusions before considering their perspective.
And be willing to, you know, to ask clarifying questions if you need to.
Yeah, especially with those ambiguous text messages.
Especially,
yeah.
And be willing to consider multiple perspectives.
Not just get stuck in my own way of seeing things.
Exactly. Try to step into the other person's shoes. See this situation from their point of view.
You know, I think that's really the heart of good interpretation, right? It's a process of dialogue.
It is, yeah.
It's about striving to understand both the message and the messenger.
Beautifully said.
And that applies, whether I'm, you know, grappling with a complex philosophical treatise or trying to decipher a text from my best friend.
Absolutely. It's all connected.
It is.
And speaking of dialogue and multiple perspectives, that's exactly what we're going to be exploring further in part three of our deep dive.
Oh, I'm excited to keep this conversation going.
Yeah, it should be good.
See you soon.
See you then.
Welcome back. It's kind of amazing how much ground we've covered already in this deep dive into the history of interpretation. You know, we started way back with the Enlightenment, talked about those big thinkers, Bacon and Descartes, Locke, and then, of course, Kant. We saw how they all grappled with this idea of how our minds actually shape how we see the world. And then we brought in Schleiermacher and his emphasis on the importance of the author and, you know, really trying to understand their intent. But now I feel like we have to kind of tackle the big question, the one that's been sort of lurking in the background this whole time.
The elephant in the room.
Yeah. Like, if our interpretations are always colored by our own, you know, perspectives and biases, like we've been talking about.
Right.
Does that mean that there's no such thing as objective truth?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Yeah. I mean, philosophers have been debating this for centuries.
Yeah. It really makes you wonder, is truth just relative? You know, is it just like up to each person to decide what's true for them? Or is there some kind of objective truth out there? Even if it's like really hard to grasp.
It's a tough one. It's definitely complex and there's no easy answer.
Right.
But I think the key takeaway from everything we've been talking about is that even if we can never be perfectly objective, we can still strive to be good interpreters.
That's a good point. It's not about just giving up on the pursuit of truth altogether.
Well,
it's more about, like, you know, being really aware of how we arrive at our conclusions and being open to different perspectives.
I love that. Yeah. It's about recognizing that, you know, interpretation is an ongoing process.
Right.
It's a kind of like a dialogue between the text and the author and the reader.
Oh, I like that. It's a dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It's about being willing to, you know, really listen to other viewpoints, even ones that we might, that might challenge our own.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's so important.
It's like that old saying, you can't really understand someone until you've walked a mile in their shoes.
Right.
But in this case, it's like we're trying to, you know, walk a mile in the author's shoes to understand their intent, to really get their message.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And this is where Schleiermacher's hermeneutical circle becomes so important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember, he emphasized that back and forth movement.
Right, between the whole and the parts.
Yes. Between trying to understand the whole text and then zooming in on those individual parts.
Yeah.
And it's like this constant refining.
Right. We're getting closer and closer to the truth.
Exactly.
Even if we never fully arrive.
It's a journey.
It is a journey, not a destination.
I love that. Yeah.
And that journey, that process of refinement.
Yeah.
It's so much richer when we actually engage in dialogue with others.
Love
when we share our interpretations and we really listen to different viewpoints, we kind of broaden our own understanding.
For sure.
And, you know, we might even discover that there are actually, like, multiple valid interpretations, each one offering kind of a different insight into the text or the issue at hand.
It's not about shutting down the conversation and clinging to our own interpretation as like the only right one.
Yeah. I think humility is really key here, right?
Oh, it's huge.
Being willing to say, hey, I might not have all the answers.
Yeah.
And I think that's a skill that's so important, especially in our world today. You know, we're constantly bombarded with information from all sides.
It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to, you know, critically evaluate all these different perspectives, even ones we might not agree with, and then form our own informed opinions.
So being a good interpreter, it's not just, you know, like a theoretical idea.
No.
It's an essential skill for navigating life.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Well, this has been such a fascinating conversation.
It has.
I feel like we've just scratched the surface, but we've covered so much ground.
We have, from the Enlightenment to today.
Yeah.
And it all kind of boils down to this. Interpretation is an art.
It is.
It's a skill. It's a lifelong pursuit.
And the more we understand about the history of interpretation and how these ideas have kind of shaped our thinking, the better equipped we are to, you know, really engage with the world around us and to do it in a thoughtful and critical and even an empathetic way, right?
I love that. Couldn't have said it better myself.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave everyone with a challenge. Keep being curious, stay open-minded, and never stop questioning.
Yes. Embrace the complexity.
Yeah.
And remember that the journey of understanding is just as important as the destination.
I love that. Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
Into this fascinating world of interpretation. We'll see you next time for another adventure in knowledge.